This week's show is sponsored by Interop ITX, the only independent conference for technology leaders. Get a year's worth of objective IT education in 1 week. Visit Interop ITX and use promo code PacketPushers for a 20% discount. Today on Packet Pushers, stupid network tricks. These are the things that we do to overcome application design issues, and sometimes there's alternatives, there's better ways to do things, and yet we network engineers seem to also often hear about some design problem and can we solve the problem in the network, whatever it is. Oh, we need to do layer 2 extension between data centers, we need to handle this security issue, we need to whatever it is, solve it in the network, which drives us bonkers, and sometimes there's better ways to do things, and part of that show is to have that discussion. And our guest today is Chris Young. Chris is a network automation nerd. He's an all-around geek. He's a consulting technical marketing engineer at HPE, and he's been on the show before. And I guess, Chris, that is your title today, right? Consulting technical marketing engineer?
Yeah, but and that's definitely where I work, although the legal department makes me feel obligated to say I don't represent them in any way, shape, or form in this, you know.
In this particular conversation,
they're not responsible for. Yes,
exactly. Not a sponsored show. This is just because we've known you for years and have been following your blog and know you're all into the automation stuff. And I saw you tweeting some stuff that prompted this chat. This goes to, sometime before the holidays, I suppose. But you were doing some AWS training, and it occurred to you as you tweeted out that there were so many problems that we solve in the network, and those problems oftentimes belong to somebody else. And then you kept going in Twitter, making the point that trill segment routing and wondering if networking should just be like, no, enough. Networking is what it is. And we don't need to keep inventing new technologies to solve what are really someone else's problems. So did I encapsulate kind of some of your thoughts there? Can you expand on that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think a lot of that is, to be very clear about what we mean by the network as well. Right. So, and I'm talking physical infrastructure, tin kit, something that you plug a console cable into. That's the part of it that I think we need to keep kind of, I know, and I think the term I usually use, we have to be the starfish. You know, the starfish is the only thing in the history of evolution that went, I'm okay. I don't need anything else. Right. I think we need to get to that kind of a point. Right. I love VXLAN.
A starfish is feature complete.
Absolutely. It is feature complete. It needs nothing else. It's just, you know, it's just there. I love the idea of overlays because it gives us a really great place to just demark and say, not my problem anymore. Right?
It's not my problem. If you want this additional functionality, throw it in the overlay. Is that what you're getting at? Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, from the physical network, again, as a network guy, anytime that two hosts are, you know, passing packets, there too I shall be. So it's still my problem, but not in what we've kind of become this horrible, the hated part of IT, where we're not allowed to change anything because when we change anything, it all breaks. And when we break, everything breaks. Right. So the idea and really what I've been looking at and I was going through an AWS training, as you said, I'm a geek. So how did I spend my vacation? I did AWS training, got Jenkins set up, started doing some automated testing. But it wasn't networking, so it wasn't work, right? So it was different.
What was it in your AWS training that got you thinking along these lines? I mean, it's been like on my list, I'm going to start getting into some AWS stuff. But was there something in that world that you said, crap, the way AWS does these things, they're not solving these problems in the network. They're doing things differently.
Well, arguably, they're still solving them in the network because somewhere in behind the magic, something cool is happening. But for the majority of the stuff, like there's no L2 really. It's all L3. It's all IP address based. When you get a load balancer, you just kind of select a load balancer. You don't even know what an IP address is. You get a DNS name. When you want to access something, you use an alias record. You use DNS. So everything is very focused on what I think we as networking people would have liked it to have been at some point in time. An L3 subnet can only exist in one availability zone. One. You can only have a subnet in one place, ever.
There's no such thing as stretching L2 between availability zones in AWS then.
No, fix it in your app.
So, in other words, if you need that app to have dual availability, you're going to have to live with having more than one IP address. Thank you very much.
And or it's not even, you don't even have to deal with multiple IP addresses, you just actually select the load balancer. And then the load balancer kind of takes care of that stuff for you in the background. Their content delivery stuff, where you literally in the S3 service just go, I'd like my content delivery to be here, here, and here, and accelerated for these guys. And just this magic happens in the background where I'm going through it, I'm bringing obviously a very network-centric perspective, and I'm counting the boxes and the number of tins or virtual appliances or whatever, the ways that we would deal with this stuff. ACLs is you basically get an ACL, which is a L4 TCP UDP port blocking. There's no L7 inspection. There's no fire up into upper protocol layers to be able to figure out where the stuff lives. Like, that's not the network's job. And it, you know, in my view, it shouldn't have been our job. Mm. But I think we got, you know, and this was the further parts of those tweets that we got to, that we as networking people, we didn't make it to the table. And from a political standpoint. And so we got left with, and I can't even, I'm sure you guys have seen this. I'm sure all the listeners have been victims of this. You show up to a meeting one day and there's a bunch of application guys with these really big smiles on their face that go, hey, we're going to do inter data center vMotion.
Yep.
They're announcing what's about to happen. As opposed to asking you in at the design level.
Yeah. And by the way, they're on the other side of the continent or across the pond. But network guy, it's your job to figure that out because that's what we need to do.
The one I've had is when SAP or Oracle turn up at your site and the company's already, the chief accountant's already bought out on SAP or Oracle or whatever. And then you sit down and they say, well, we've got this SLA and here's what you have to build. And so you have to buy storage arrays that do storage replication and you have to be able to have an identical installation of, you know, and these software apps like are worth like 10, 20, 30 million and are meant to have a decade long life cycle. And those companies like Oracle and SAP just never ever built them to be HA. It wasn't a require, though they were, as far as they were concerned, as long as it was working, that was fine. And it was up to the infrastructure to fix that. That's the sort of thing that you're talking about, right?
Absolutely. And really one of the biggest objections we come up with is, but the laws of physics.
Yeah. The speed of light. You know,
speed of light, like,
have you seen the cost of a synchronizing, you know, a storage array that can synchronize?
Exactly. And because we weren't at the table, we're viewed as kind of the naysayers, the crotchety old guys, and we just tell them why it can't be done. And we can't really tell them how it should be done because we're left with these craplications and we weren't at the table. So we weren't even at the part of the design where we could have said, hey, you might want to rethink this, or if you swizzle it like that, or if you do this, we might have more success here.
Yeah, but I've been in those situations before, though, and you kind of learn after a few times, like, oh, man, they're having a project meeting about X, and you have a choice. You can sit there in your chair and wait until they give you the bad news, or you can do your best to try to get a seat at that table so you're involved more at the beginning of the project, so you have some input, and you can say, guys, you don't want to do that for these reasons, before they're all sitting there with that look on their face going, ha, 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 guess what, we've already decided, and you're going to somehow make work.
I think that's why they have that smile on their face.
But I mean, do you agree with me, though, that it's something about network folks that we tend to want to not get involved and just kind of sit back and, you know, we kind of have that MacGyver mentality of, oh, whatever it is, I'm sure I can figure out something that'll make it work.
It's kind of ironic that networking hasn't changed in 20 years and yet we're all still studying.
Huh.
Like it. And yeah, it's the hero culture.
Yeah, but we're not studying. The thing that we're studying is not new stuff, surely. So we're still studying BGP and MPLS, which hasn't changed substantially since 1998, really, when it first came out.
Well, we say networking hasn't changed in 20 years. That is partly true, Greg. But if we look at what this show has covered since 2010. It's been things that have changed. Now, it hasn't been fundamental changes like, totally changing a dressing or something very fundamental, but it's been all these little solutions that have come to market. Early in the days of packet pushers, we were covering Ethernet fabrics. That was a big thing we spent a lot of time on, Shortest Path Bridging, Trill, and the various solutions that came to market for that, none of which really took hold, and then SDN and OpenFlow was sexy, and none of those solutions fundamentally change networking, and yet all of those solutions are still around in some form or another, but by and large, some of them have gone by the wayside. So I think a lot of the learning that's being done is, well, I've got this very specific problem that vendor X makes this specific solution to address, and so now I've got to learn that thing that layers on top of, you know, the fundamentals of networking that I've already got, which I think goes back to your point, Chris, of maybe networking needs to become the starfish and say, yeah, enough evolving already.
I was having a conversation with Ajay at Interop last year, and his view of networking now is if Amazon doesn't do it, he doesn't want to do it in the enterprise side. Right. So he's trying to get back down to that, like look at what's new, host routing on Docker and what Calico is doing, BGP from the host. Look, one of the earliest kludges that we have as networking people, HSRP, VRRP.
Why would you do that if you have host routing? Yeah,
exactly. If the host was just intelligent enough to have two gateways, right? It's not like we're asking too much. Two, right. Just two, please.
Right.
And yet, right? And it doesn't even need to have full routing protocol support. It could have been just figure out two gateways, please.
Two gateways and a keep alive. And if one goes down, switch to the other one. Done.
Yep.
Well, it's funny, as you study large-scale network design, you have very large networks that can scale to tens, hundreds of thousands of hosts. They are very simple. They are very cookie-cutter and repeatable. There's not much complexity to them because you can't scale with a lot of complexity. You end up with a large dependency tree. And so, and host routing is one of those that it seems to keep coming up in conversations more and more over the last couple of years, where that's a normal way of doing things. And it's not super scary to be running a BGP daemon on a host to help simplify the underlying network fabric even more. And I think that it's got to be a requirement of Amazon's that the network is as simple as it possibly can be. I mean, no simpler, but as simple as it possibly can be. And so it becomes easy to say, look, we can't build a global network infrastructure that is going to run all of this public cloud infrastructure without it being simple, because it's going to break. It will be too fragile. And therefore, I'm sorry, guys. No, you can't run layer 2 extension. You can't run the same layer 3 domain in more than one availability zone. That would make our network too complex. And then there's a lesson that we can, the rest of us could learn about that. And yet, Chris, it comes back to that political concern. We didn't get a seat at the table. We didn't have an opportunity to provide input into the design step of an application. And so we're left with a craplication that we have to engineer the network around to provide the resiliency and redundancy that's required to keep the application up.
Absolutely. I think one of the things, kind of the bright, shiny spots that I see in this potentially is, and I haven't seen it come up in, I don't think I saw it come up in 2016, but was the fallacies of distributed computing, written by some guys at Sun in the 90s at some point in time. And this was a set of rules that application developers were supposed to kind of follow. And it kind of dispels the myths that, hey, I develop on my laptop and everything works fine. It works fine on my box. Right. Well, no, don't assume the network's always stable. Don't assume that latency is zero. Don't, all these. It's almost, we as networking guys, we're kind of going for probably between, since SDN became a term, so let's say 2011-ish, that paper came up every year, and then somebody else would discover it and tweet it out. And it's almost as if Amazon is coming at it from the other angle and forcing them into that. It's forcing application developers to develop to Amazon spec as well, which means that we're starting to get into good distributed application development, good architectures.
Well, the implication there is, as a developer, it's not reasonable to be completely ignorant of infrastructure and infrastructure design. And that's been a theme In a lot of the more developer-oriented talks I've seen, for example, there was some that were run in Serverless Conference where the point was made, look, just because you're accessing an API that gives you some sort of a resource that you can then latch hold of and deploy doesn't mean you don't have to think about operations. You still have to think about scale. You still have to think about availability. Querying an API and getting an answer back in your testing is going to work for proof of concept, but that's not application design. You have to consider infrastructure, no matter how abstracted that infrastructure is.
And absolutely. And part of what Amazon is forcing them to do, if you look at things like Lambda Service and some of the Elastic Beanstalk, some of their very developer-focused services, is that they're forcing them into a situation where they have to think about, well, how many regions, how many availability zones, where do you want this stuff to actually run? And by forcing them into that situation, it makes them think about those. Well, how am I going to be doing? Am I going to be doing a full L7 load balancer? Am I going to do a traditional load balancer where it's just IP address one, IP address two, IP address one, IP address two, right? And really makes them think about the infrastructure side of not routing, but what actually affects their applications.
Well, is it,
if that makes sense,
is it developers that are having to think about this, or is it networking people that are having to think about this, or is it both? I mean, I from a lot of the conversations I'm having on the DataKnots podcast, it seems like those lines are getting blurrier.
I think it's developers for sure. Like, so I've been doing some Flask app application development on the side, and I discovered that I can deploy my Flask app to Elastic Beanstalk, which is a service that Amazon offers, where I can just take my application, freeze it, and then take those files, and as a zip file, I could just upload them through AWS console. And it will automatically worry about the auto-scaling, the distributing, the, you know, it. To me, I'm looking at it, and of course, I don't understand it yet, but it looks like magic. And that's purely, absolutely focused on the developer side. It has nothing to do with the networking person. I think we as networking people have to become aware of the underside of these things, because inevitably, something goes wrong. And the developer not having an understanding and a background in networking isn't going to be able to have that intuition built up to understand what could have gone wrong, i.e. your database is in, for compliance reasons, somewhere across the world, you know, locked into the UK, and yet your application's being developed in regions all over or deployed in regions all over APJ or EMEA or Australia. Right, so there's still going to be these things where I think we as networking professionals, absolutely our intuition that we've built over the last 10, 15, 20, 5, whatever, however long and however many gory details you've seen in your career, we're still necessary. We're still a necessary component. And I think we're just going to have to move further up stack. What I would love to see is that the application, the networking, the physical layer just becomes that very, very simple. Right, we could, as an industry, almost agree on it's going to be a BGP, L3, ECMP, L3, at least to the edge. And would spanning tree, would people find love for spanning tree again? I don't know. Like, it's, or VTP, we don't need VLANs anymore to the same degree. You know, how many things would go away if we didn't have spanning tree?
Right. So I guess the question then becomes for, you know, people that are running an enterprise network out there, is that sort of a design, what you just described, layer three, ECMP, BGP as a routing protocol, going all the way up to the host if possible, is that deployable everywhere? It's not typical. I mean, you don't see that typically.
I don't think it's deployable, maybe up to the host. I don't think that's deployable yet. And I don't know if it ever will be in the enterprise, seen as the most of the typical hosts in an enterprise now are accessing over wireless. But I think if you look at a lot of the wireless solutions that are tunneling back to a controller somewhere, yeah, it's just an overlay. I think it could be.
We could break this up into multiple networks, though. Greg, this is a point that you've made, that your network isn't a network. It's actually several different networks stitched together.
Yeah.
Well, it's not one system. The mistake that a lot of people make is just because it's a bit like what people do with families. They think that everybody who belongs in a family is one thing and they're all the same. At a distance, that's true. But when you get up close, of course, you realize that every person in the family is a completely different person. They're an individual. Everyone works differently, acts differently, responds differently. And people conveniently forget that when they get far enough away and say, it's one family. It's not that. And in the same way, the same cognitive dissonance that you get, that people just as humans, they just want to redact things down to something really dumb and simple. At the simplest term inside the enterprise, you've got a WAN, you've got a data center network, you've got a campus network. But even within those definitions, you might have an MPLS WAN and a VPN WAN, and you might in the data center have the production WAN, the production DC and the pre-prod DC and the DMZ where your security is, and you might have a test lab. So all of a sudden, you've gone from, I've got one network to three types of network, to 10 or 12 different networks inside my data, inside my corporate infrastructure. And now increasingly, I've now got networks in the cloud. So I might have an AWS network or an Azure network or a GCE network. And then on top of that, I'm going to lay some sort of overlay technology, which attempts to start to bring those back into some part of the whole where they communicate together. So it's not, I think the big mistake that we make is we try and just try and say there's just one network. It's not. It's multiple networks, and each one's unique, and each one's got different problems. And sure, they all connect together, but that doesn't make them one. It just means there's a loose abstraction where the WAN connects to the data center, where the data center connects to the campus, and so on and so forth.
And yeah, that's true. I like to think of those as architectural blocks. Right, that'd be the term that I would use for that is I have my data center architectural block, I have my campus block. And absolutely, there's a point where they deviate and have a whole bunch of different requirements. But I also think to a large degree, if you're talking, WAN is a different one, right? Because we're into a whole different set of technologies and interconnects. Yeah, most of it's Ethernet, but there's other stuff out there. But for data center and campus, I think you still could get that foundational layer of just, okay, how do we get packets from point A to point B and get that extremely stable? I still think that's a possibility. Right. What we put over top of that, whether that's it's a Aruba, Cisco, whoever is left as far as wireless overlay, wireless controlled solution, or whether that's an NSX, Nuage data center overlay solution, you know, we'll let those deal with the upper level yeah. of typically what the host would connect to. But the network itself, I think, could be having a very, very yes. hard demarc point.
Yeah, I mean, and what happens with the overlay? Is that a separate network or is that still part of your network too? And what happens if the overlay network in the data center is not run by you? Is it still one network?
I would say no.
arguably, right?
Yeah, yep.
And this is the point is that, and I think that makes me very, you know, sort of narked about it, is that even operationally we have firewall engineers or there's engineers who generally, and I'm generalizing, right, for the sake of the debate here, which is most companies say this person's in the DMZ, they know how to operate the firewalls and the networking stuff, the proxy servers and the firewalls and the IPSs and all that sort of stuff and know how to configure security. But there's another set of engineers who run the data center LAN and they work more closely with the server people. And over here is the campus WAN and they work very closely with the desktop people and they're worried about the technologies or more familiar with the technologies that drive campus, especially in very large companies, right? And then don't forget wireless. I mean, wireless is a whole discipline of its own.
Absolutely.
And I think the challenge here is that part of the diversity, this comes back to your point about why don't we solve this stuff in the application? And I think the answer here is that the network has certainly historically been incredibly diverse. It was token ringed, it was Ethernet, it was FDDI, it was ARCnet. And we abstracted it away so that the operating system would hide the networking away. And, you know, Windows 3.1 gave us network drivers, which made things easier. And then the application developers didn't know. I mean, there was a time going far enough back in history where the application people actually wrote their own protocols. Yep. That's why we had things like Apollo XNS and Banyan Vines and IPX SPX and, you know, all that
ARCnet.
Sort of stuff. Well, ARCnet was a layer two. It was a transmission mechanism. But, you know, they actually wrote protocols that ran over the top of them, their own custom. So every application had its own custom protocol that came with it, right? And there's, remember those of us who are old enough to remember, there used to be like an A2 poster and it had all the protocols that was put out, you know, the Sniffer company. Remember that poster?
Yep. Absolutely. I remember doing IPX to IPv4 proxy networks on Novell 3.1.1.2, like proxy gateways. I'm like,
yeah, I can remember doing NetBIOS over NetBIOS, over NetBUI. You know, I've done Apollo XNS, Banyan Vines, AppleTalk, you know, all that sort of stuff that's just gone. That back in the day, they knew about what I'm trying. I think my point that I'm trying to make in a very roundabout kind of way is back in the day, the application people were familiar with networks because they wrote their protocols. And at some point, we put abstractions in so the application developers didn't have to think about the network. They just knew that if they, you know, did a HTTP, whatever the modern, you know, file open on Linux, or, you know, do a get, load the what developers are doing today is they just load the HTTP library and say get URL. And they completely, to them, the network is truly invisible. And so what we present to them, or what the operating system, what the infrastructure is presenting to the developers, sort of promotes an attitude of, I'm not interested, and you don't have to be interested, right? We're going to break it down to this, just, you know, call the URL, and all of a sudden, mystically, DNS happens, TCP windows, sliding windows, networking packets propagate mysteriously. Why does the developer need to know? And that's the transition, is we made networking widely available, and we're making it simple. So in some senses, we don't want to be complaining about that, because as an industry, we let them use the network. So when they use it, we shouldn't kind of complain about them actually using it.
But I don't know that what we did was made it simple. When we absolve people, you know, it's the RFC 1925. It's easier to move a problem than fix a problem. And we ended up taking the responsibility for those problems, took it upon ourselves for them, and by doing so, increased the fragility and the brittleness of our networks.
Right. Yeah, there's a wall that went in both ways here. Greg, you were talking about the abstraction that went in from the development standpoint, where they don't have to understand the network, and vice versa. As operations and infrastructure people, we haven't had to understand applications all that well either, other than the occasions of looking in Wireshark at packet dumps and seeing what the decodes tell us and making some inferences about how the application is actually working. I mean, this goes all the way back. You guys were talking about, you know, NetWare back in the day and so on, and I remember taking packet captures where trying to explain to a developer why his SQL query worked great in the LAN and worked like crap over the T1 because of the huge table set he was pulling back with the SQL query, stuff like that. So there's a lack of understanding that goes both ways until you dig in. And I think there's a couple of points here. One is it's become no longer acceptable from either side, either infrastructure looking up at the application riding on top of that infrastructure, or developers looking down at the infrastructure their app's riding on. You can't just look at the wall, the abstraction layers there, and go, up, oh, I don't know, it hit the wall. It's magic after that. Everybody's got to know, we can't all know everything about everything, but there's got to be some amount of insight into what's going on with an app from an infrastructure perspective and what's going on in the infrastructure from an app, a developer perspective, to effectively be able to deploy these applications. And the people that have already learned those lessons are the Amazons and the Googles and the Facebooks of the world that have figured this stuff out and have put their rules in place for how to deploy an app. And Google published the Site Reliability Engineering book, and we hear presentations from Facebooks and so on and go, oh, well, they're so big, I don't know that what they do matters. But of course, there are those lessons that we can take away. We are going to take a quick break from our main discussion because we want to let you know about the conference the Packet Pushers are going to be at in May 2017. That is Interop ITX, and they are a sponsor of today's show. Interop ITX, this is where tech pros go to get objective, full-stack IT education. Interop ITX takes place May 15th through 19th, 2017 at the MGM in Las Vegas. So join Greg Farrell and me, that Ethan Banks, for the Future of Networking Summit. We're excited about this because this is our gig. This is a two-day session where we are going to take a deep dive into next-generation developments in the wide area, in the data center. We're going to look at network operations. We're going to talk about things like software-defined security, any of the cool stuff that we think is going to really matter in the next 1, 5, 10 years, we are going to talk about. Greg and I will be speaking. Drew is going to be speaking, and we're going to have some special guests that we are bringing in to talk about the future of networking. That's the point of this summit. It's a really big deal. Register for Interop ITX and you can attend our summit and then other hands-on workshops like the Future of Data, the Container Crash Course, Dark Reading Cybersecurity Summit, and the Open Source IT Summit. The event's conference tracks focus on security, DevOps, cloud, infrastructure, data and analytics, all the technologies that you need for a successful full-stack IT strategy. So you got the conference summits, you've got the workshops, and then you've got the conference tracks that you can attend as well. Basically, you can mainline a lot of information from the industry during the Interop ITX conference. Okay, so if you're looking to accelerate your career, there's also plenty of sessions on leadership and professional development. So not just the techie stuff, but that practical business stuff as well. And then if you want to see what's going on in the industry, you can check out over 100 vendors at Interop ITX's Business Hall, and you're going to have an opportunity there to check out what's leading and then what's emerging as you look at all the tech vendors that are there and see what they have to offer. So join us, the Packet Pushers, at Interop ITX this coming May. Use promo code PACKETPUSHERS when you register, and you will receive a 20% discount. We definitely want to see you in Vegas. We do our very best to hang out with as many people as we can, chat, and just see what's going on in the real world. So go to Interop ITX and reserve your spot today. One more time, promo code PACKETPUSHERS gets you a 20% discount. Chris, I want to circle back around to this. Well, I guess we could kind of describe it as the MacGyver mentality. We take it on ourselves as network engineers to just be the hero and kind of duct tape a solution together and make it go. And I know from my perspective, I've been in those situations where I'm sitting here scratching my head going, all right, they want to do what? Okay, well, if I do, oh, I don't want to do that, but I know I could make it work. And you kind of get to that point where it's like, ah, crap, I figured out a solution. I know I can make it work. And so now I can't tell them no. And then you do it, even though you wish you hadn't have done it. I mean, are we saying that we're at this point where we should be pushing back and saying no?
I wish more people would. I wish, and I think you have to do it responsibly. Right? I think just saying no is a good way to create a revenue resume generating event. If you just say no, you're now just another part of the problem. Right. I think we have to come back and be more responsible and say, look, we can do it, but this is the consequences of making this decision. And it would be awesome if we could have just apply a stats model and say, okay, this is what my, assuming that there was actually a golden configuration for your switches and routers. This is the golden configuration for these switches. And by doing this, you've now crossed your 10% off of standard deviation, or 20% off of your standard deviation, or something like that. And just saying, I don't know what the right way to deal with the management structure is. If I did, I'd be making, lots of money elsewhere to get them to do what I want all the time. But I would love to see some kind of a equation to say, look, if you do this, that's fine, but you are now, your risk factor has just gone up by 3% or 5% or 10%. And give them some, take it like the Six Sigma methodology, where they have magic math to pull numbers out of nothing and make it reasonable for executives.
I've been in that situation before, though. It's interesting because you're in a meeting with all of the stakeholders involved. There's managers and there's developers and there's infrastructure people. And for whatever reason, some element of the design has come down to, can networking do X or not, whatever X might be. And it's like, well, here's, you whiteboard it up. I figured this out. This will work, but it's awful. It's kludgy. And the risk is this if we do this, and we really shouldn't do this. I can make it work, but we shouldn't. And inevitably, they always go ahead and do it anyway. And so I like what your thought is there. If you could put it into some sort of an official, a recognized metric, Six Sigma, or some sort of a format such that management will look at it and go, okay, well, we understand that this is a risk and it's a calculated risk and we're going to go, or it's beyond a threshold and it's no longer acceptable. We need to redesign. But so often it seems like these problems come up against time. We've got to deploy the application by X date on the calendar, or there's some consequence, and they don't want to be subject to that consequence. And so the decision is, we're going to go for it. We're going to do it. We understand there's risk. Yep, fine. Just go for it.
And, but I think that's part to your point, though. I feel the risk here is unacceptable. I feel that it's a kludge. I feel that, and I'm relying on how you feel. It's like I'm glad we're sharing feelings, but the application guy over here, he's giving me all these, and here's my numbers of how much money we're going to lose if we don't have, this application. Every day that we go past this point, I can quantifiably show you that we're losing, $1.2 million a day in revenue, or something like that. That's what typically those meetings show up to, right? Is there is some kind of a statistically quantifiable mathematical number. Now, whether that number is, you know, 1.2 million, how does that happen? Like, where did that number come from? You know, it's we all know how those numbers get generated, but it's a real number as opposed to a feeling. And
it's a real number pulled from a dark place oftentimes, but someone can use some sort of a formula that came up with it. But someone's trying to demonstrate that some thought went into this and it's worth the risk because of this number that was pulled out of the dark place. So then this goes back to kind of a process issue. We as infrastructure people, network people, need to be involved in application design processes that are going to impact infrastructure early on. Absolutely. So that's a cultural thing.
Yep, absolutely, we do. And I think we need to be better at communicating in the way that the business needs to be talked to.
So one step that I have taken in previous lifetimes would be, hey, I heard Project X is going on. I would like to sit in those meetings. I don't want to cause trouble. I just want to sit in, hear what you guys are working on, and make sure we're going to be able to do whatever it is that you're doing with this project. And then once they learn they can trust you and you're not going to be the guy that goes in there and day one starts saying no, it's not such a bad thing. But you've got to... So many network people I found tend to be introverted, not extroverted. They just love to sit in their fabric covered boxes with their dual or triple monitor setups, flip the Dilbert calendar from day to day and do their thing quietly and not, you know, fly into the radar and just be the silent hero that makes things go. They don't want to be sitting in meetings because, geez, meetings, right? And they don't want to be in any sort of a situation where there's a need for confrontation or conflict, or there might be, because that makes introverted people feel really uncomfortable. And yet, you're just putting off the inevitable if you don't. The situations that I've been in are worse if now it's the decisions have been made. There's been a lot of commitment made to code and there's an application delivery schedule that's got to be adhered to now. And yes, you've been pulled in too late because you didn't pop your head out of the gopher hole and say, hey, I should be involved in this project. And now you're stuck with whatever you've got.
And now instead of being part of the project, you're having something done to you.
Now it's deliver this as opposed to help us design this.
And your eyeballs are screaming and your fingers are just crunching up and you're hitting that button to do that NAT-based PBR strange NQA IPSLA trill over VXLAN over IPGRE MPLS thing, and you're hitting that button. You're going to hit enter, and every part of your body is screaming to not do it, and you do it anyways because it was done to you.
Just to do a deviation, I noticed that the IETF passed a trill RFC to do default layer 3 gateway detection. So instead of having just flat layer 2, you can actually have multiple layer 3 gateways. So you don't actually have to trunk the traffic across the Ethernet fabric.
I've heard someone's working on a better horseshoe too.
It's like,
So Chris, I want to go back to this notion of the simplicity then, just since you raised that point, Greg, which is like, well, let's add more complexity to this thing and reinvent that wheel again. If we this also goes back to a talk I gave at Interop last year. Kind of my goal of the talk wasn't to advocate for one specific topology necessarily, but was to raise the point, geez, why don't we start simplifying things and doing things according to a standard? And I was riffing on the BGP standard for the data center. Well, at the time, it was a draft. Now it is an official RFC, although I've forgotten the number. Hey, there are standard ways you can build data centers. So if you want to talk about architectural blocks and we want to talk about making the data center architectural block very simple, use layer 3, use BGP. And if you follow this standard IETF ratified RFC, you're not going to be doing layer 2 extension, et cetera. You're going to be building a underlay, and you might have an overlay on top of it of some kind, but you're not going to be running in that underlay, stretch layer 2 all over the data center with complex spanning trees. You're going to be simplifying, keeping that design simple, and then when you get pulled into the design discussion early on and say, we need to do X with this application, you can say, ah, our standard data center fabric that we operate doesn't do that. You would need the application to work like this to leverage the simple design of our data center. If you've got that in place and your standards compliant, then you can use that, I think, as a, I don't want to say a weapon, but like a tool, a calling card in the design discussions to say, look, we're adhering to a standard. We're not going to go outside of the standard to accommodate some goofy application. Geez, Amazon doesn't do it that way, et cetera. And you can kind of refer back to that. But if your design of your data center is this spiderweb disaster of you, Chris, you were making a joke of trill over this, over this, over this, over this. If it looks like that and you've done it in the past, then ugh. So I think there's a impetus for networking engineers, infrastructure experts to begin standardizing what their data centers look like so that it's easy to say no because, hey, we're standards compliant and we've got a simple network. And therefore, your applications need to take this infrastructure into consideration and design with that in mind.
Sometimes I'm still really working on the thought process around this, but I think I'm starting to think of the network as a microservices architecture. Where if you look from a development standpoint, where you've got this service, it has a specific set of requirements. It's got an API contract. How things get implemented internally doesn't matter to anybody else. But the external interfaces of how other things interact with it has to be incredibly stable and has to always work the same way. And if you're going to change that, you better let everybody else around you know. Well, maybe that the first microservice is routing. Just that L3, right? Maybe that's a way. I haven't thought the whole analogy through yet, but that's one way that I'm starting to think about. How do we break this up?
I'm not sure about that. I think we need to understand the difference between service and platform. So if you're building your service might be the TCP session that runs end to end and the path that it traverses. And in that sense, yes, we are a microservice because you don't have to define the path between two endpoints. It exists. We instantiate the network as needed. You do a TCP open and then the other end responds and then the service. So if you want to look at it at that point, yes, we are a microservice or a service oriented, but there's a platform underneath the service in the same way, for example, that Cloud Foundry supports containers so that you can have platform as a service. You need a platform underneath. So I tend to see the network as more of a platform.
And it might be, but I think the analogy still kind of holds in that if you think about how most people think about the network today, it's a monolithic app. And that's why it's so brittle and fragile, is because we don't, as we were just talking about, we view it as the architectural blocks and these separate segmented things that all have these different requirements. But I think to a large degree, a lot of people still view it as a single entity, which is why we have these large blast domains and L2 everywhere. Maybe?
No. I think the abstractions... I'm not sure I agree. I can see where you're going, but I'm not sure that the abstraction, that you're seeing the abstractions in the sense that in the operating system, I can make a call, a file open, or open a HTTP library to make and request a data exchange. And the TCP library is fully abstracted away in the same way that, when you're writing code in Python or when you call an Ansible playbook, you don't actually know what's happening underneath. In the sense that it is possible to run an Ansible playbook and never actually understand, some of the modules that sit under there. And some of those are extraordinary, right?
Yep, absolutely.
When I think about the SCP module that was written by Kirk Byers in his, what's it called again?
NetMiko.
I think about the complexity inside of NetMiko. You're like, but you don't need to know NetMiko to be able to use Ansible to be able to talk to the switch. And in the same way, networking is the same thing. So you don't need to know TCP or TCP IP addressing to be able to use the network. And in fact, 99.9999% of the 6 billion people in the world who are connected to the internet have no concept of how TCP works, right? And if they had to, they wouldn't be able to do anything.
And yet developers are still hard coding IPv4 addresses.
Again, in the bigger picture, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I get it. Yeah.
And that's where developers who, practices from 10, 15, 20 years ago. That's a people problem, perhaps, where developers who were hard coding IP addresses 10, 15, 20 years ago are still doing it today because that always seemed to solve problems. It's a bit like people setting full duplex on 10 gig links. That's still very common, very common question that comes up in the public forums. Why can't I set, you know, statically set the duplex on 10 gig? And it's like, you can't, it's not dynamic. It's not a setting you can have. It's fixed at auto. it's not something that you can configure. And they go, but that's not how it works. And you go like, no, the duplex problem in 100 meg and in gig was a problem of that era, not a problem that was, you know, was designed out. And So no, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think what we have is a people problem where certain people carry a long history or don't know enough or haven't taken the time to understand what the change is, or the networking that they're working on isn't modernized. I mean, if you think about the thing that I was listening to a podcast today talking about security in the electricity industry, the electricity generation and transmission industry. And the simple history is, of course, is that the electricity infrastructure is 50 years old. A lot of the IT that's in it is 20 years old, actually probably older. But and so expecting them to start using modern encryption methods and to change all of that, those systems are never inherently going to be secure because they're 20 years old. They were built in an era where you couldn't even connect to them without magic and the special wizard coming along with a coaxial cable and blah, blah, blah. And so now everything's changed. And those networks have a whole bunch of different problems. So, you know, there's modern networks, what we do in the cloud, you know, what AWS and Google Compute and Azure are doing at their networks, you know, with virtual instantiation and dynamic creation and NatPat on demand, firewalls on demand, is just so far away from where we were just 20 years ago. 20 years ago, I would have still deploying Token Ring. No joke, right? Uh-huh. 20 years ago, I was still deploying it in 2002, 2003, brand new switches into networks running Token Ring and, you know, or FIDI or ATM still within the last 20 years. It's not that long ago that things, you know, we are moving very, very fast. A lot of the times we get on the podcast, we talk about SDN and, you know, 40 gig and 100 gig Ethernet and white box switching. But I've always conscious of what's happened in the past because that's got our feet nailed to the floor. But I don't want to talk about that all the time because it's boring. It's known. It should be understood. People should know that that's, you know, but, you know, cursing about history doesn't actually change it. And it probably won't make it go away either. So
I think what we need to do, though, is we need to be responsible for our own problems first. Right, to kind of bring it back around. That's what I think we need to be responsible for, fixing the network problems. And I think the whole push towards automation is a way of doing that, because it forces you to standardize configurations. It forces you to clean up your environment. It forces you into things like naming conventions that are predictable.
There's an article I read by Fred Trotter this week. He's a developer, and his gripe was about the different formats and naming conventions that certain services he was consuming would throw at him, just driving him bonkers trying to code, because they would, like, everything would be the same except for like these two little weird things. It's like, would you please be consistent? Stuff like that affects everybody up and down the stack.
Like what's the proper format for a MAC address?
Colons or hyphens
four or two?
Right.
And is it 2 2 2 2 2 or is it 4 4 4?
Or is it 6 and 6? Yeah. I've seen that one as well.
Yeah. Like, let's give me an RFC that tells me what the proper format for a MAC address is. That I'd love to see. You know, that it's things like that I think that we are so busy cleaning up other people's messes. And now the cobbler's kids have no shoes, kind of thing. That's how I feel right now. Is that I'm looking at things like what Amazon is doing, where I can drop code in and it just magically disperses itself. And yet we haven't found a way for Spanning Tree to magically auto configure itself. When, as a system, it should be able to do that. LDP should be able to infer what the system is doing. We're still doing L2 stretched VLANs to fix the application guys' problems because they have a crap application and they want to do these bizarre things. And yet we haven't fundamentally fixed our own stuff.
Well, Spanning Tree will configure itself, just not well.
Yeah, true.
So I have a go at this? I have a pet theory here.
Sure.
So if you think about where we are with private cloud, in reality, the systems that AWS has built and, you know, Google Compute and Azure and whoever else you want to talk about, those are all using exactly the same components that we use to build our data centers in the enterprise IT. So there's no physical reason why we can't build systems like AWS.
Yep.
So what we need is some software to do that. Now, instead of So where are we today? VMware has been out there trying to promote its software-defined data center, where you have software and networking and software-controlled, you know, vRealize doing scheduling of the vSAN and the NSX and the ESX hypervisors, and giving you something much more closely to an ES, which looks like Amazon. And yet the vendors who are partnering with VMware haven't produced simple AWS-like, why can't I go and get a HPE rack that has everything in it to build 500 VMs that look just like AWS. And on there runs VMware's vRealize with an API that just allowed me to go clicky, clicky. And VMware went out of its way to build solutions like VxRack and VxRail, and they never really took off because the vendors never really went and got behind them. And, you know, Cisco's out there talking, building these hyperconverged solutions with every vendor under, every storage vendor under the sun, including their own, and trying to build these sort of systems that customers will buy. But all they're doing, I think, is making it harder to buy because now there's 20 solutions. So when you go to buy, you spend all of your time dealing with, I could buy one of 10 different hyperconverged solutions with Cisco, this storage vendor, this storage vendor, this storage vendor, or this one. Or I could go and look at Nutanix, and Nutanix has this hyperconverged. And then HPE's got, again, you know, 4, 5, 10 different, and I could use my legacy stuff. And by the end time you've evaluated all that, you're like, heck, let's just go to AWS and get the job done.
Yep.
Do you know, I just think that our current vendors haven't sort of managed yet to deliver this, you know, click a button, an instance is created, a rack, you know, that rack scale architecture or half rack scale architecture, whatever.
I think there are certain vendors that did do that, and those they're getting closer, but they're not all there. And most of the ones that I've seen are, they have these assumptions that I'm not sure are good assumptions, right? I think the assumption is the underlying network is stable, that latency is known and predictable, right? We're back to the fallacies of distributed computing, right? And now is it, from an architectural standpoint, when I'm designing my data center, should I be able to know that within a data center? Sure. I think you should be able to know that the network is stable, but I don't know that it always is. I think the assumption is there, but I don't know if that reflects the reality. If that makes sense. And I think we're getting closer. I think the trust and working for a vendor, this is a hard thing to stomach, but the trust of vendors I've seen has gone way, way down in the last 5-10 years.
I mean, the trust of vendors by customers, you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. The days of the trusted IT advisor, I think still exists in for some people, but that becomes a very personal thing. It's not, I have an at xyzcompany.com email address, so therefore I'm your trusted advisor, which I think is what it was maybe 15 years ago.
It is very personal in that if the right human walks through the door and you have a good experience with them and they take the time to understand your business and give you good advice, then you trust them. But you know, as soon as their colleague walks in the door, you're starting the relationship over, or more or less.
You don't implicitly trust IBM. Or you know, vendor of choice. You don't just, that's the one that I want. I don't care who it is. I don't care who else walks in the door, right? That's the vendor I trust. And I think that's part of the other problem is now you have been burnt so many times as customers. Part of me hopes.
My sense of that is that when there was no other alternative, we all just bent over and took it, right? And said, thank you very much, sir. Can I have another? And now all of a sudden there are alternatives. We're seeing the emergence of open source, so I can turn away from my vendors. I'm seeing the emergence of, you know, white box or low cost x86 server, so I can turn away from my vendors. I'm seeing storage systems that I can build myself. And now even more so, you're seeing Amazon, AWS, you know, GCE offer alternatives that people can turn to that are actually very easy to consume, and you can use them to beat the vendor over the head. I don't think the customer's ever had as much negotiating power now as they've ever had. Like, that we've just never had that negotiating power in 20 years. The vendors had all the cards, and it's rather delicious, I think, that we can take a shot.
I think the negotiating power versus trust. I think we've never had more power now than what we've had as customers. But I think the trust 20 years ago, you trusted your vendors, maybe it was a naive trust, but I think that you trusted the vendor a lot more than what I see today. Now, you look at things, perfect example, you look at Onug. There are sessions where vendors aren't even allowed in the room.
Yes, exactly.
Right. What does that tell you about the industry that we're in right now, right? Like that's a phenomenal case in point.
I've got a video of one where our CIO of the American Army is basically saying that we can no longer afford to buy MPLS technology from the mainstream vendors because they're changing it all the time. And by the time we go through a 5 to 8 year buying cycle, it's obsolete. So we must have open technology so that we can go and make changes to it to keep it working. Because by the time these vendors have sold, you know, we bought it, evaluated it, bought it, tested it, and got it into the theater, into the, you know, where military operations, where the warfighters are operating, it's obsolete. They know that. But they also know that they can't continue the way they're doing. And they're threatening to, they're going to open. The vendors are actually driving customers away from them. There's certain types of customers being driven away from the vendors because the vendors are modernizing so fast. And, you know, they're starting to end of life products much quicker. We're seeing, I've talked about this on Network Break podcast, the weekly Network Break podcast a lot, where vendors have to stop holding onto products for 10, 20 years because white box can come out faster. Switches, you know, x86 servers can now outperform most of the mid-range routers, and even some of the high-end routers can be outperformed by a VM running on an x86 server with an Ethernet interface. There's nothing magical about a router.
Greg, let me come back around to one of the points we made earlier in the show, which was why have we continued to evolve? What problems are being solved, and are we solving them in the right way for the right reasons, or should we be back to a simpler network? And if we are back to a simpler network, are we in a situation where we need an open platform because we've got to keep up with the latest and greatest and have it be easy for us to implement these latest and greatest features? If we have a simple network that's doing a simple and predictable thing, all of a sudden it gets hopefully very boring and stable, and you could run it for 5 to 8 or 10 years and put the complexity out at the edge or up in the overlay.
And I think this is where software-defined, right? This is the software-defined bugaboo where, yes, it's a marketing term and, yes, it's much abused, but to me, it's very straightforward. Software allows us to simplify the network because we're getting back to this models. So in the software defined, I create a model of what this VLAN function looks like, or this is what a VLAN, if I create a VLAN, it needs an IP address, it needs blah, blah, blah. And now I have a model, and it should replicate, it should make less and less sense for people to keep changing those models because I should just keep reusing the same thing over and over and start forcing consistency on the network, right? When you're cutting every network change by hand, the tendency to make a little optimization because you know best is just overwhelming, right? But increasingly, I think we're starting to see, SDN. And now what we're also starting to see is these intent-based modeling solutions. So now that the protocols like Yang, you know, modeled APIs, NetConf and Yang give us, we're now starting to see solutions like Apstra and Glue and all of those companies that we've had, you know, talking on the show about their things. And they're now saying, instead of, we'll give you an application where you just click a model and then you say, I want to make a change, and the model will validate whether that change is legitimate or not. And again, no deviation from the model. You can't go around and futz with it.
Intent translates to a very specific model, and it translates to that model the same way every time. Mm.
I think simplicity is often just consistency. If only your network interfaces were all configured the same, if only your QoS strategy was consistent across 5 different vendors and 10 different hardware platforms and buffers, you know, if only, now, and it's simply no longer possible because, and again, it's not possible now, it was possible in the past for people like us to manually configure all of this when we had 50 or 100 devices in the network. But now what we have is we have these overlays, we have literally thousands of endpoints of nodes in the networks where before it was tens or maybe hundreds. It's no longer possible to do it manually. So we need software to solve that. And there's a gap in between where we scaled up our, you know, fingers on the keyboard to the point where we just can't keep up with it anymore. You can manually configure a DEM VPN network. You have to have a software tool like Cisco's Epic EM, or at the very least, to be able to control things like key management. You can't rotate keys manually like we did. You know, back in the days when I was configuring a network that had 20 to 30 VPN endpoints, it was easy enough to rotate the keys. When you've got 100, that's like a lot of work. Uh-huh. And so software defined is just this thing about using applications. But once you start doing it with a software, in the same way that Microsoft Word forces you to work a certain way to fit Microsoft Word, software defined makes you simplify and be consistent. And a lot of these intent-driven or semi-automated or moving into orchestration, things like, you know, NSX and PlumGrid and all of those SDN products that we've worked with over the years, those are all creating certain models and certain systems that actually just simplify the network through consistency. And I think perhaps that's the answer we're hoping for.
Well, so maybe it's not software defined, but software enhanced networking, right? It's just enhancing what you as a networking engineer already do.
Yes. And so certainly that's what companies like Glue do. They'll take you create the templates and the profiles, and then it will go and reliably, it'll do some validation and some intelligence to it. But Apstra does it slightly differently, and they say, we have predefined these models. We think that this is the way that you will do that. And if you use this, this will do the configuration and give you the outcome that you want. And sure, you can still go and look into it and check and validate it. It's just like Cisco Security Manager from 8-10 years ago. You create the policy, but you can still see what goes down to the device. But the simplicity here is the consistency that if you do this, this will happen. If I create a VLAN, everything's configured exactly the same way. I don't end up with, you know, the classic one when we were manually configuring our spanning trees is someone got almost all of the spanning tree configuration done, but missed a couple of the backup switches. You know, and then when it failed over, the spanning tree wasn't right, and then it blew up. You know, and that's what I think software defined is going to help us going forward. Because the network has got more devices and it's more complicated than it's ever been before.
Well, guys, we've kind of, this conversation's done what we so often do here on Packet Pushers. We took a left turn somewhere and got into other things, but this was one of those conversations that I like having because it's forcing us to think as we do network design, why we're doing what we're doing and whether we're doing things for the right reasons or not. Moving applications into the cloud is forcing a lot of us to rethink how our networks look and whether the decisions that we've made have been wise ones or not. And Chris, thanks for coming on the show today. I love following your tweets when you're angry and so on. As angry as you can be for a Canadian, you know, really.
What was it? I'm the guy that puts the crotch in crotchety.
There you go. So Chris, if people want to follow you on the internet, how do they do that?
And ladies, he's available.
No. Look over there. So you can follow me at NetmanChris on Twitter. Blogging. I've been spending way more time writing code than blogging, but you can find it at controlissueswithak.net. And hopefully, you know, that's one of my New Year's resolutions to get back to doing a little bit more blogging in 2017. So hopefully we'll have some more content coming out there soon.
I'm Ethan Banks. You can follow me at EC Banks on Twitter. Greg is at Ethereal Mind. You can follow him there. The show, of course, is Packet Pushers, and you can follow this show, which is our weekly show, and all of our shows at Packet Pushers on Twitter, and then at packetpushers.net. There you will find the weekly show, which is what you're listening to now, the Priority Queue, where we go even deeper and nerdier into networking stuff, Data Knots, which is about infrastructure engineering, moving applications to cloud, and storage, security, anything to do with infrastructure engineering, you can find at Datanauts, along with Network Break, which is the weekly news and analysis show as we keep up with what's going on in Silicon Valley. And all of that, plus our community blog, etc. Again, one more time, packetpushers.net. If you want to find us on LinkedIn, because that's where we like to follow things, we're there. If you want to like us on Facebook, hey, we're there too. And rate us on iTunes, if you wouldn't mind. That would be a wonderful thing to help boost this show and let even more people know that Packet Pushers is there for you. And last but not least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.